Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
Welcome to the official Tennis.com podcast, featuring professional coach and community leader, Kamau Murray.
Welcome to the Tennis.com podcast. I am your host, Kamau Murray, and we've got a lot to talk about this week. We've got a lot of tennis happening around the world, a lot of tennis-related news that's become global headlines. But first, let's talk about Alexander Zverev winning his second European championships. We saw him this year have the most consistent results he's ever had in Grand Slams, and now finishing the year where he proves to be the top dog, where only the best of the best are present. Congratulations to Alex. Who knows? Next year, we can finally see him get that Grand Slam title. It all starts with some consistent results of going deep in slams, which he did this year, and then now playing a year in and coming out, I think he's positioning himself well to have his best season yet. And in Guadalajara, we saw the best woman on the WTA Tour show up to an action-packed Grand Slam atmosphere in Guadalajara. It was so great to see all the fans come out and see probably the best tennis crowd we've seen all year. And we saw, honestly, the best player of the second half of the season, Garbiñe Muguruza, rise to the top. We saw her have a good deep run at the U.S. Open with a loss there, with some questionable medical timeouts and injury timeouts that probably sort of ended her run sooner than it should have. We saw her win a title at the 500. And then we saw her lose the first round against Karolina Pliskova and end up coming out on top at the end of the day, holding the trophy. So congratulations to Garbiñe. I don't think there's any surprise in seeing her emerge and hold that trophy at the end. And our first guest is somebody that's very familiar to me. It's a player that I've watched hit tennis balls since she was 10 years old, always knew she had world-class talent. But again, in big cities like Chicago, one wrong turn, one wrong move can really stunt your growth and end your career. And I think that Caroline Dohide, who we're going to sit down and chat with now, is an example of staying with one coach in one situation her entire junior career before she's ready to sort of expand her wings and turn pro. But I'm happy to see her has some a lot of success on the double side so far, and then now starting to show some consistent results on the single side. So Caroline and I sit down and we talk, we reminisce about some Chicago days, what went right, what could have went wrong, and the trap that a lot of people fall into growing up in big cities with a bunch of tennis clubs and a bunch of kids. Take a listen. Welcome to the Tennis.com podcast. I'm your host, Kamau Murray, and today we have a Chicago legend.
Yes, thank you.
Caroline Dohide, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So, I watched you play tennis since you were like 7 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And always proud of your success. But tell me how it is being one of three girls living in, like when you first started, Courtney was like the superstar.
Yeah, yeah.
And you had to like follow it up.
Uh-huh.
And you rose to the occasion and went past it.
Yeah.
And then talk about the pressure that Stephanie has now, right? Because theoretically she should have learned from both of you guys. So tell me about what it's like to live in the shadow of your sister and then.
For sure. So I played a lot of sports growing up, but when Courtney took on tennis and started doing very, very well in tennis, I was like, okay, I'm gonna drop everything else and I'm gonna start really trying and competing in tennis. Competing hard to not only like push past the level that she reached, but to kind of follow in her footsteps. So I was on track to go to UCLA just like her. And then I made the decision to go pro. So I took that a little bit more seriously. And then from there, I just trained harder, trained smarter. And having her as a role model was great growing up. I mean, she always was all honors this, like, passed everything. So it was really nice to have such a great leader in our family to look up to. And, I mean, that started from my parents, so I'm really lucky. And then Stephanie following it up, that's a tough one because I went pro. So, like, it's really hard to follow that in tennis. But she did something that is incredible, and she's at West Point, like you know. Mm-hmm. And she's a senior there doing really well, playing for their tennis team. And they have a great team there. So, yeah, all the girls in my family are doing well. Yeah.
So
is my brother, by the way. My brother's doing great.
The golf star, right?
He's at Baylor University assistant coach. So he's doing well, too, in athletics. So.
I don't blame him. He's the boy. He was like, yeah, y'all can have this.
He was my mom's favorite, so.
Oh, I was one of four. Okay. And it's funny, we have that same debate on who was the favorite.
Oh, really?
So I'm number three.
Oh.
You're number three.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm number three in the family. And I always say I was like the invisible middle. Who had to like find my own way.
Yeah.
I wasn't the smartest, I wasn't the tallest, I wasn't the shortest.
But did you have like two girls, two boys?
Or? Two girls, two boys.
Okay, so, but Brian's the only boy, so it's like, oh, my mom's favorite for sure.
Oh my God, right. Y'all gonna have that debate over Thanksgiving.
Yeah, I guess so.
So you and Courtney were like on the same trajectory, looking at the same schools. Yeah. How did you decide to skip college? Like what was there a tournament? Was there a company? Or an agent that was like, hey, you can make it. What made you go left?
Yeah, it was more of a personal decision and just, I was training very, very hard. I was at the USTA in Orlando and I was just working so hard day in, day out with my coach, Steven. And he told me when we started when I was 17 that when the day comes, he's gonna tell me honestly what he thinks about my game. And he told me that he thought that I could make it and he saw a great future in professional tennis with me. And I thought about it, and I thought about it, and then one day I just woke up and I was like, okay, I'm gonna do this. And I was so committed, like I called my mom, I was like, Mom, I'm going pro, like I'm training so hard, like I'm working hard, I have everything set here. And my mom was like, hold up, what? Like, cause everyone's going to college, like my family, everyone at my school, we all go to college. We don't go pro, you know?
Right.
So I was like, Mom, like I'm going pro, like I have a feeling, it was like deep down and I just committed to it.
And then she say, well, how are you gonna pay for it? I mean, like, who's gonna pay for that?
No, it was all those questions that a normal parent would have.
Yeah.
She called me back like 15 times, but but it worked out and she backed me in the end and so did everyone else in my family. So I have a lot of support.
Very cool. So your mom is one of the famous tennis moms who's like got this quiet disposition.
Yeah.
But you look around and she's sort of like always there. Pretending to be on her phone, but she's really like ear hustling, listening, watching the match.
She hustles, she works. So she's always there just for a face that I can see whenever I like have her come to a tournament. But she's working and she's such a hard worker. She works for Cisco, a technology company, so she's on the phone all the time. But she has so much support for me and I really love her so much.
So you are in like a bunch where it's like a crowded bunch, where there's a ton of talent. And I think America is like waiting for one of you to break through, like you, Usway, Haley, Whitney, like that group is like the next wave of American players.
Yeah.
What do you think, like when you look at, you know, the wave of Canadians, right, or some of the French, or some of the Czech players, what do you think your group needs to take the next step?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You do see a lot of younger Europeans come up, and we have been like stuck between that 100, 200, and we haven't really pushed past that. I think that my move to hire my own coach, hire my own physical trainer was a big first step for me because I was with the USTA for 4 years. So taking it like step by step, I guess, was a really good thing to, I guess, start that push. But I don't know, our games are all so different. We all come from like so many different places that I think just focusing on our game and what we can do better is best, like especially physically. Mm-hmm. Like if we can all physically be dominant and really commit to our games, I think we can push past that 100 and further.
So you've had a great career, played world team tennis, doubles finals. You've made enough money now to make some good purchases.
Yeah.
So I talked to DC about her purchases, right? You know, things that she regret, things she overspent on. Tell me about your first big to you.
Okay, big to me was a house. I bought a house and I look at that as like a very big purchase, but it's also like an investment.
Right.
So that was a very big purchase. I'm so happy I did that because I bought it in 2020 before like all of the real estate and everything like jumped like crazy. Mm-hmm. So I was a bit lucky there. I haven't had a regret in any purchases I've made. I don't know, I've been pretty smart so far.
No bags, no shoes, no heels.
Okay, I have Valentino heels, but
See?
That's it.
that's coming it. Out. You're like, I haven't even been purchased. Oh,
no,
what?
No, but that's it. I swear to God. Like, so far, I mean, I don't know. I try to be really smart with my money and invest, and I don't know. You do have to celebrate a little bit, but I usually do that with time spent with my family, trips with them, and stuff like that.
You sound so responsible.
I am a little bit too responsible.
I know, like so responsible, so boring. I want to hear like, you know what? I was in French Open and I went into, you know, Gucci, Prada, and it just is one person that just had to have it.
I'll get to that point once I start pushing past that point in singles, when I break through there. There, you can interview me and I'm sure there will be a lot of stories there.
I know, I'm gonna come to your house and check that closet.
Oh yeah.
You didn't mention these.
Yeah.
So you're from Chicago, and one of the things I find about Chicago tennis is there's so many indoor clubs in Chicago, and you feel like every year the same group of kids just migrates from club to club. Yes. And because they migrate and stay in the same group, they never like push past. Mm-hmm. When you look back on like your junior career, specifically like in that period,
yeah,
trying to like find the right club, the right coach, the right group,
for sure,
get your competitive, what do you look back on as like, that was a waste of time, I should have stayed here. What do you take from like the Chicago scene,
yeah,
of like migration?
I think that one regret I would say is I stayed in our Midwestern area too long. I wish I could have played a little bit more ITFs or had that experience younger, mm-hmm, just a little bit. Not a lot, but I started that when I was like 16, 16, 17. So I kind of wish that I could have done that at like maybe 13, play like a few ITFs and like come back. I don't know where I would be if I did, but. But honestly, I think the biggest thing from that is committing to a coach and committing to a club, because you have all those players that move around from club to club and they don't have that commitment from the coach. And then they're learning from five different coaches and then their game keeps getting mixed up and mixed around. But I was with Tom Lockhart from when I was 5 years old to when I was 17. So I stuck with him for all that time, and that was really good for my game. And then there came to a point where he was like, you need to push past this level, like go to USTA, where there's professional coaches that you can get the professional training that you need.
But that's good of him to like,
yeah, no, definitely,
let you go.
Definitely, and it was hard, but it was definitely something I needed to do.
So you've had the opportunity to obviously play a full schedule,
uh-huh,
right? You know, you got the age limitation when you were younger, yeah, and you first started. Give me your best Grand Slam, like your favorite Grand Slam.
Favorite Grand Slam. Okay, U.S. Open's my favorite Grand Slam.
Every American, blah, blah.
Yeah, right. But French Open has something in my heart. I don't know what it is. Like, the whole center is so close-knit together. All the people are just kind of, like, integrated through us players, too. You just walk right next to them. The courts are really intimate. And I love clay. I love sliding on the clay. I love when it rains a little bit. Paris is amazing. So yeah, French Open is top, I would say.
Top, okay. So.
And that's not a lot. A lot of players don't really say that, but.
Yeah, French Open can be rough.
Yeah.
You know, you got the cigarette smoke.
And
you got the rain.
Yeah, but the cigarette smoke, I haven't seen that in a few years.
Well, you're no fans, right?
Yeah.
Or like fewer fans.
Yeah.
So I find like.
That's true.
Sometimes it can be a little claustrophobic going from court to court, and you have all the smoke, and you're literally walking past somebody, yeah, and in the middle of their like puff.
Yeah. Like, yeah, puff.
Right in your
I
face.
I remember that, yeah. But like maybe a part of me just misses all that, because before COVID it was like there were thousands and thousands and thousands of people.
I know. So favorite tournament that's not a slam, favorite stop on tour, mm-hmm, favorite city, that's not one of the Grand Slams.
I would say Indian Wells. Maybe. Yeah, Indian Wells, because the courts are amazing, the facility is incredible, and the food is also really great. The acai bowls are amazing. I mean, that's like one of my favorite foods at a tournament, because it's so easy and you digest it so fast. So good.
So I have like a little rapid fire kind of things, and maybe some of these you don't know yet because you're still perfecting your routine, but maybe some. All right, now, Wimbledon.
Okay.
Court 18 or court 3?
Court 3.
Okay. Hotel or Airbnb?
Hotel.
Bananas or bars?
Bananas.
Ugh.
Yuck. Bananas.
You're like the first person to say bananas.
Bananas. Bars are, I don't do bars anymore. Bananas are like quick energy. I like it.
Okay. Eat in or
Wait,
go out? Eat in, like eat in your room.
Oh,
like
okay.
Uber Eats now, right?
Okay,
now
we've
been
yes.
stuck in bubbles.
Okay.
Uber Eats or go to a restaurant with your team?
Restaurant with your team.
Okay. Early practice or sleep in?
Early practice.
Basket or live ball?
Basket.
Oh.
I love basket.
Gatorade or Powerade?
Gatorade.
Here's a good one, since we just played with this Hawkeye. Hawkeye or Real Bounce?
Hawkeye. Hawkeye, for sure. Oh, I thought you were talking about like the new company that's out there, because that new company, let me tell
definitely
you.
Definitely no go.
No go. No, so live calling. I would want to do live calling.
But you know, in Asia, they got the Real Bounce where the ball like goes and you see it from the side and like, you yeah like that or Hawkeye?
I like that. I like that because I feel like that technology is very accurate.
Yeah. You can see the ball kind of compress.
Yes. Okay, so if we're talking that level, then that.
Okay. Breakfast at Wimbledon or breakfast in Asia?
Breakfast at Wimbledon.
Really?
Yes, 100%.
The best meal of the day in Asia is breakfast.
I would not agree with that.
Oh my goodness, like the only
they have their pecking duck. Their pecking duck for like lunch is amazing.
In Asia?
Yes.
I eat like one meal a
but
day.
But I've only been to Asia once. So
okay, so I've been like six times. Okay. So you gotta like go like five more times. Maybe. And then you'd be like, you know what?
Maybe
Kanaan's
two
right
more times to then realize, yeah.
Yeah, you know, you're gonna be starting like 8 o'clock and you're like jet lag and awake and like nothing's open. You can be like, man, I wish I was listening to you gotta like carb load in the run. Yeah. So goals. Uh-huh. Right? Right now you've had tons of success in doubles. Obviously everybody wants to like sort of succeed in singles.
Yeah.
But like next year, right, you've seen a lot of young players sort of emerge and evolve and probably take a lot of confidence from like, okay, if she can do it, I can do it. I serve big, my forehand's big. Yeah. What are like your goals for the next year?
Yeah, one huge one is to start using my forehand better, more efficiently, because I've been working on my backhand so much that I kind of tend to run around and hit a little bit too many. So that's a big one. And then improving my location of my serve is always a good one because I have a fast serve, like you know. So location matters just as much. So I would say those two are huge things. And then from there, I think my game's just going to come together. Yeah.
And one more lighthearted question. Mm-hmm. When you do get the bag, mm-hmm, what's going to be the first thing you buy?
All right. That's a good question. That's a very good question. Man. I always keep going to the responsible option, but I'm not going to be responsible this time. I have to get a bag. I have to get a really nice bag. I would say, I wouldn't say Louis Vuitton. Hold on. Give it a second. Something from Gucci. Let's just say something from Gucci.
You can get a Gucci bag with a doubles title. You don't have to wait.
Yeah, but like the exclusive, like back room stuff. Not like the, like the, I'm going to go to the counter, I get that.
You want that Paris, like, make an appointment.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Like back room. Like take me to the back room.
Well, you got to like go with Danielle and Bethany. You know, they get that back room action all the time.
Oh, my God. I bet they do.
Well, thank you, Caroline. Like I said, I enjoy watching you play now just as much as I did when I was like, looking at it, like, that girl got a big serve, big forehand. She might be something.
Thank you.
So now, you know, those forehands, when you were 10, they used to hit the curtain.
Yeah.
Now they like landing
yeah,
in.
Yeah, now they're going in.
Now they're going in. I'm like, all right.
I took that risk when I was a kid, right, and now it's paying off.
Oh, you would load up on that thing, and I'd be like, duh.
Where's it going?
Look out for the hole in the back curtain.
Right? Literally. Good time.
But always root for you, and congratulations on your success, and keep going.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at newbalance.com.
And now, we want to welcome to the show a Bayesian legend, Darian King. This is a dude I've had a lot of opportunity to spend a lot of time with traveling, on the road, staying in hotels, practicing. Really good person, really good dude. Always brings a good energy and a good vibe to the tennis court. Keeps it lighthearted. The epitome of an island boy with his swagger, his demeanor. But we talk about what it's like to make it out of a country like the Bahamas. where there's not a lot of tennis pedigree and not a lot of opportunity. Take a listen. All right, welcome to the Tennis.com podcast. I'm your host, Kamal Murray. We are here with the Bayesian legend, DK, Darian King, my homie. We spent a lot of time together, hotels, LA, traveling, dinners, sitting, watching girls' matches, having a good laugh, man. Welcome to the show, bro.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure being here.
So tell us about your journey, because you got a real interesting story, how you from Barbados, moved to Florida. Your brother's obviously been instrumental in your tennis, but sort of kind of finding your own path. I know you spent time with Martin, et cetera. Tell us about like your tennis journey, how you started, et cetera.
Yeah, for me, a crazy one. Tennis obviously wasn't my first sport growing up.
Oh, what'd you play?
I'm footballer.
You mean soccer?
Soccer you guys call it, but in Barbados we call it football because there's a foot and a ball. I don't know why I can make it so. But my first love was football, soccer. And yeah, gradually eased into tennis. It was just a school thing. They used to bring the tennis into school and I volunteered to go and participate in a tournament. And luckily I won the tournament and that's how my career kind of shot. Now I got a offer from the Hilton Tennis Club. Sidney Lopez, one of my first coaches who actually introduced me and stuff to tennis and gave me an offer to come and practice there. And I was just, talent had it. But for me, obviously, as I told you, football is my first love. And results, I can say, is what really brought me through all this, an easy decision for me. Playing a couple of tournaments, obviously, in the ITF area, Barbados Open, well, not Open, but the ITF. I was winning all of these Caribbean tournaments, Jamaica. So rapidly, my ranking went up to 100 quickly just from winning these ITF tournaments. I was number one in Cotet, which is all the Central and South America, just from winning these tournaments. But yeah, crazy journey, meaning the results is what made a easy decision for me. I was 14 in the world in ITF, just from playing these tournaments, as I say, winning doubles with Brandon Burke and stuff. And yeah, and easy decision. I mean, my brother, big part, who played a big major part for me to continue to play tennis. My mom and my dad, who is not into tennis, who knows nothing about tennis. So, I mean, for me, for Barbados, it's just for me to put them on the map in this discipline. Tennis is a tough sport. Expenses is obviously crazy high and stuff. But luckily, I used to do well in the ITF and the COTEP people used to help me out to assist me to travel. To various countries and to participate. So there's a lot of people I need to thank, obviously, but I can't sit down here and tell you a crazy everything, but a lot of people on this journey that I need to shout out for, and I'm happy that I'm living the dream right now.
I'll tell you, I was in a bar one time, and this dude, you know, he was had that accent. Yeah. I was like, "Are you from Barbados?" He said, "Yeah." I was like, "Oh, okay." I was like, "Oh, you know, one of my homies, by the way, he played tennis." He said, "Darian King. He's legendary, boy, boy." I was like, "Really?" He was like, "Oh, no, he's like a celebrity in Barbados." And I was like, "So is that true? Like, when you go there, is it like, oh, DK is in the building?"
Trying to be the just under, iconic, just under Rihanna, trying to make my name up there.
But Rihanna?
I'm happily, I would take it. I'm happily hope people see that, oh, Darian King, just from tennis, I mean, is a dream. I mean, I'm happy because, as I say, the sport isn't big. So for me to actually project the sport out there to people to know from Barbados and in the Caribbean, oh, they're tennis players. I mean, I'm happy for that.
So at what point did you move to Florida?
I would say the age of 18.
Now, did you get a scholarship? Did like somebody see you play some ITF?
Yeah, just Bill Adams, who helped me. He has an academy there in Miramar. And he was trying to get a good group of the Caribbean, the best of the Caribbean, we'll try to call it. He saw the potential in me, spoke to my parents, and so he's like, "Hey, this guy has great talent. He needs to come in the tennis hub in Florida," which is obviously where big tennis is. And he gave me an offer to come and practice with the guys. And as I said, results again. When I came over, I started winning the Casellis and all this stuff. And yeah, crazy journey, and he offered. I started to get in to meet a lot of people, and and stuff in the tennis arena there in Florida, which is, as I told you, where tennis belongs. And from then on, never tried to go back to Barbados. I knew that for me to make it, I had to change my mindset and stuff to be over here and for me to improve.
Now, did your parents move with you, or they just sent you with Chris?
They just sent me. They were like, you need to go. And I just said, they didn't know anything about tennis. Luckily, I had a brother that understood what was going on, obviously speaking to people and that kind of stuff really helped. And he kind of grasped it and was like, for you to achieve anything, you have to get out of Barbados and that kind of stuff. So as I say, a lot of people to shout out to.
I find that that's so common with parents just take, if somebody whispers in the ear, the kid got talent, and they just send them. I remember the first time my parents sent me out of town to stay with a dude, his name Tony Wamadou in Memphis. And I was 11 years old, and they sent me on the Greyhound bus by myself. And that Greyhound be stopping in like cities. It's not like a direct shot. 11-year-old on the Greyhound with, people smoking cigarettes on the bus and,
Greyhounds and stuff tough.
Hey, people on drugs and stuff. They sitting there sleeping, all kind of stuff. And we stopping in like little podunk towns. I'm like, you gonna put me on this bus? I'm like, you don't wanna call them and meet them? You don't wanna come with me? They're like, nah, you good. Let us know when you get there. I'm like, damn, that. So, but that's so common with parents just say, hey, he got talent, we're going to send him to you. Yeah, good luck.
Yeah, sacrifices and stuff. Obviously, your parents and stuff had to put through for you to be rich where you are now. You never know. I'm older and now looking back and I'm like, geez, it's a crazy journey.
So you've been in, first of all, everybody I talk to, I'll talk about anybody outside of 100 that's like a super talent, right, or most underrated player, and everybody be like, Darian King. Like literally everybody from people who are 40 in the world, so whatever, it's always DK. Yeah. So you've played every slam. You've been top 100 in the world, like in and out of top 100. What do you think you need to do? Or at what point in your career did you like need a little, where you were felt like you were on the cusp and maybe it let it slip, where it slipped with an injury or scheduling or whatever?
Yeah, at that point, I would say I was more organized and a structure. I had a structure. Not running, going back home because, you miss your family and stuff, which is, I guess, a lot of tennis players and stuff go through. You're missing your family, missing your friends. You have to change your environment and stuff. But those few years that I was hovering and stuff around 100 and stuff, I was like, Darren, you have to lock down and you have to focus. If you want to really achieve, you have to really, be there and stop running home and doing that stuff, change your mindset. And yeah, I just think I was more structured, more organized in my practices. I had one not jumping from here to different academies, and then you're hearing different stuff from coaches. And as I'm sure a lot of tennis players would say, knowing yourself, knowing your game. I think that I'm not the biggest player on tour, the strongest or what's not. I just try to, massage and be tactical. And obviously you have to think out there. And I just try to use my speed and stuff to the best of my ability. And easier when you have coaches that understand your game instead of trying to change a lot and then you're getting more flustered. You go through all this stuff, frustration and stuff builds up. And as I say, knowing yourself and I was more structured and stuff, I think, gave me that big boost and confidence. So for every time I stepped on the court, it made it easier for me in matches. So all the hard work I was putting in off court made it easier for me in matches and just trying to execute game plans.
So you keep talking about knowing yourself. When I think about a lot of tennis players, they got no idea who they are as a tennis player, who they are as a person. When people describe you, they can never really put their finger on it, but they know you give them a fit. So how would you describe yourself as a player? What do you think your strength is and your weapon is that makes you so deceptive but so dangerous?
Speed and calmness and just being calm. Play every point the same way. You might not. It might look like I'm out there. Oh, this guy doesn't care or what's not. I'm telling
boy.
You. Yeah, maybe that's just the genes and stuff. But I'm out there actually putting in 110%, like trying to win every point. And yeah, with my speed and as being crafty and obviously changing up my game style, meaning depending on the opponent and stuff, game plans and stuff. That's what really win matches. Everyone can hit the ball technically, and that kind of stuff is thinking on court, finding a way, of course, when you're down and being frustrated, finding ways to dig yourself out of those holes and stuff. I think I was really good at that. I would just say speed. As I say, I'm not the strongest. I don't have a big serve like Ulysses and these guys, but I just try to find a way to win the points. And I think that's my biggest strength. Finding ways, I think, yeah.
So you've, because you've got into slams, you've maybe gotten in without a seed, you have the opportunity to play against a lot of seeds and a lot of top players. If you could put together the perfect player, right, stroke by stroke. So we'll start with the serve. Best serve on tour, first and second, because we know people be getting the yips, right? We have some of the yips on the second, yes. Right? So first serve, you could take the first serve.
I would go John Isner, obviously.
John Isner on the first. What about the second?
Riley. Big kick. Big kick serve Riley have. Unreal.
All right, what about forehand?
Fernando Gonzalez. Yeah, I went back Asian for you guys. Yeah, I went all time for you guys. Yeah, Gonzalez on the real forehand. You know, you see this guy's forehand, your eyes light up. So, it's, yeah, for sure, Fernando Gonzalez.
Backhand.
Tricky one. I think I have two, Djokovic or Medvedev, but obviously Medvedev is not the tennis stroke that the normal coaches teach, but Kai doesn't miss a backhand. So, I would go Medvedev. Although the unusual technique, but guy doesn't miss backhands. Very solid.
IQ. Tennis IQ.
No, Novak. Joker. Guy understands the court like he write it out. I don't know. The guy, he knows where to be. He knows where to put the ball, where the ball's going to come. Yeah, easily.
Speed, other than yourself.
Monfils.
Good one.
I'm acing this. I know. I got you guys really good. I got you guys good here, bro.
All right, best player outside the top 100. And you're a disadvantage because everybody always says you. So now you can't say yourself.
Man, it's crazy. You have all these youngsters now coming up. For me, I feel like a veteran outside the top 100. Boy.
See, you was talking all that shit. Nah, I got you.
Nah, I got you stumped. Because now it's changed. Like, all these youngsters coming out and so talented.
They're not staying 100 for long. They're like, boom, 100 and boom, 60.
Yeah, like the Tommy Paul. Like, when I was coming up, it was Tommy Paul, Francis, all these guys. But now I can't. These guys are in 30 in the world and 20, so I can't even mention these guys. Jeez. Stop. I would just have to go with friends now then. Mike Mo.
Oh, Mike Mo. That's a good one.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Talented dude.
So in addition to being obviously a veteran on the men's side, you've had a lot of time to watch a lot of women's tennis. Me and you watched several matches side by side. What do you think the biggest difference is between men's tennis and women's tennis?
I would go with emotions. Handling emotions, I think guys handle it way better. They can level out the concentration levels and stuff. I think for ladies, it's erratic. It goes all over the place. And yeah, emotions, meaning staying in the moment, not getting too high, not dropping your intensity too low. I've seen it for sure in the ladies that just one point of stuff can change a whole match, just like that. So yeah, I would go with emotions easily.
That's good. Well, this has been the Tennis.com podcast. We're here with the Bayesian legend, Darian King, my homie. I appreciate you for coming on.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you, brother.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
And last but not least, we sit down with Ulysses Blanche, a dude that I personally thought was from New York City until I sat down and got to know his story. One of the biggest serves on tour. I mean, you know, you're at the practice court and you just hear a cannon and you look around and say, whose racket did that ball come out of? And it's Ulysses Blanche, one of the great American up-and-comers, originally from Florida via Puerto Rico. And we sit down and get to know him, get to know his story, his journey, and honestly, some things that we here in US can do better to support people in his position, that 100 to 200 range. Let's take a listen and see if we can all learn something about Ulysses. Welcome to the Tennis.com podcast. I'm your host, Kamal Murray, and we are with a growing superstar in American tennis. Always mistaken of being from New York, not from New York, from South Florida, Ulysses Blunt. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, five different people have told me over the years, oh, he's from New York. And I'm like, dude's not from New York. He's like, no, he's definitely from New York. And I'm like, the dude is not from New York. So tell me how that rumor got started.
I mean, I think it's because I played for New York a couple years. I played, my first team tennis was like 2 years ago. I played for them the whole season and then been helping them out like last year. And I mean, I get along with everyone on the team. So I think it's because of that. I don't know. I really don't know because I've never spent over like a week there. So.
All right. So you're not paying New York City taxes. Are you?
No.
But I think also like your runs or like your success in the States, you've had always got the wild card to the U.S. Open, you know, had great matches in the first round of the U.S. Open. I think that also contributes the way the crowd sort of pseudo-adopts you as a New Yorker, too. I mean, I've seen your matches on court 6 and 7, and like, who's playing on court 7? It's like, this is Ulysses Blunt.
Yeah, I like playing. I mean, who doesn't like playing in New York? I mean, it's a joke. Yeah. The people and all that is great,
So we talk about, like, people who are, right now you're 23, right, and you are, you know, hovering, trying to get in the top 100 and remain in the top 100. Who's the person that's between 100 and 200 that's probably the most talented person out there that people may not know, besides yourself?
From anywhere?
Anywhere.
100 to 200. Darren King.
DK, living legend. Darren King. Living legend.
Living legend is a veteran, you know, he's been around for a while and... Yeah, it's too easy. It's too easy when he's on court, the stuff he does. That's whatever he wants, you know.
And he says it, too.
Yeah, he says it.
Too easy, boy.
Yeah, it's too easy, too easy.
But he's got that island feel where it's like, he's like, never seems like he's running real fast, but he back there, like, he's back to 5 feet.
He looks like he's chilling. Like, I played him a couple years back in Tiburon, I think, or something. And I was out there running side to side, you know, trying to win the points. The guy was just touching me around the court. Too easy, you know.
Because I think a lot of players, like you look at someone that's 23 years old, been on the tour, what, 5 years now?
Yeah, sort of, I guess.
And you wonder, like, you know, at what point did you decide and what was the trigger that said, you know what, I'm going to go pro, I'm not going to go to college?
I think for me, in my case, it was more of a growing up thing. I think it was just, like, the environment I grew up in with my dad and all that and the way I would train since I was young. It was always on going pro. My family's not really, is not American, so they don't really have the college, you know, culture or the, you know, the customs, I think, that, you know, people have here in the States. So for us, it was always, I was going to go pro. I didn't really think about college at any moment, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
So was your dad your coach?
No, but he was very present all the time, you know, always on me and all that, but no, he wasn't my coach.
Like a typical tennis dad.
Yeah, typical tennis dad.
Always back there picking up balls, telling the coach, we need to do more open stand, we need to do this. I was like, bro.
Telling everyone, me too,
So is that where your love for the game came from, or is that who introduced you and sort of pushed you?
Yeah, he's definitely the one that put me into tennis, because I used to do other sports too, soccer and all that, but he put me in tennis, and then I think after like, 3-4 years of doing a bunch of sports. He wanted me to be a little more serious about it. And obviously, like, I was taking it more of a job thing more than the other sports, which was for fun. And for me, I already, like, kind of understood what I had to do. And, yeah, I mean, I loved it. So it was easy for me, yeah.
Now, most people don't know, but you're actually from Puerto Rico.
Yeah, I was born there.
And then you sort of moved to South Florida. And then, like, the tennis hub and tennis.
Yeah, I mean, I never actually moved to South Florida. I was born in Puerto Rico, but then I went to Seattle when I was young, and then when I was really young, and then we kind of just went to Asia. So I grew up in Asia, and then South Florida I would always come to practice because obviously, you know, the tennis situation there wasn't the best, so whenever I would have holidays from school, I would go to South Florida. So most of the time I spent in the States, kind of growing up, was in South Florida, yeah.
So you kind of get that Canadian thing. You see a lot of Canadian players.
Yeah.
They're actually from somewhere else, moved to Canada. So you are... from Puerto Rico, by way of Asia, and now Florida.
By way of everywhere, yeah.
So did you ever consider playing Davis Cup for either of those countries?
No.
No?
No, never. No, it didn't really cross my mind either. I mean, I grew up I grew up in an American school, even though it was over there, so all my friends, I mean, were American, and I mean, I guess I never really lived here, but everything was whatever, NBA and tennis and golf and football and all this, and yeah, I mean, I always felt American, so no doubts.
So when I think of you as a player, everyone I was talking about, biggest serve, one of the biggest servers on tour, definitely sort of one of the most, you know, underrated players, and sort of once he rounds out his games, to sort of, you know, add to his serve, he'll be like, you know, a serious threat on tour. What right now are you working on to sort of complement that?
I think the main focus is kind of giving myself the right environment. Because, you know, tennis is a single sport. I mean, you're alone out there, but I do think that there's a lot going on behind the scenes that, you know, contributes to your game and all that. So I think it's putting myself in the right environment year out, and then trying to develop physically as well. So, yeah.
So you've had the opportunity to play in every Grand Slam.
Yeah.
So which is your favorite and why?
New York. New York's my favorite, and because of the people. I think it's just the city itself. I think the times that you're not at the tennis court, you're kind of in the city, and I think that influences a little bit as well. And it's just New York's New York, you know, and then when you step on the court and the people and just being at home, I think it's just, it's different. Even though, I mean, slam's a slam, I think New York's just different for me, yeah.
So then when you think about sort of the global nature of the game, it takes you to all different stops on the tour.
Yeah.
What's your favorite or the most memorable city that's not a Grand Slam? Not like something like Rome, Madrid, something that's like a, you know, a Premier Five or anything like that.
I mean, this year I went to South Africa. Kind of off the top of my head, because I'd never been really to Africa to play. And going to South Africa and, you know, it was really different. And I think it was a cool experience, even though it was, you know, in the pandemic and all that. But, yeah, I mean, I think South Africa could be one.
So who's your best friend on tour? Like, sort of when I think of, like, the men's tour, whether it's, like, pseudo or whether it's legit, I feel like the top 25 are cool with the top 25, right?
Yeah.
And then you get people who are like, you know, 26 to 75 kind of together, and you get the guys that are like 100 to 200 that like grind it out going
from,
you know, 125 to 125 and all that kind of thing. Who's like the dude that you travel the most with or your best friend on tour?
Well, I think the first guys are the guys in Orlando. Because I've been training in Orlando for a while, so I mean, I see the guys every day, and I think, you know, Patrick Kipson, Vasil Kirkov, and I train with Bjorn. We have the same coach, Vitangelo. I get along with them really well, obviously, because I see them every day, Mackie as well. And then a lot of the South Americans, because I grew up in South America later on, and a lot of them I've known since I was 12, you know, and we kind of grew up together, so yeah, I'd say a couple guys from Argentina. Yeah.
So when you think about like that life, right, traveling, trying to get points so you can get 106 in the world, yeah, direct entry into the slams, a lot of people don't see that part of it, right? They see the slams, they see everybody posting on Instagram,
yeah,
they come in the airport, and hey, we arrived in Madrid and Rome. But there's a whole nother sort of tour,
yeah,
right? And those people are like so committed, not taking it for granted, wanting it so bad. Tell me what you think the biggest challenge is for someone that's like hovering around 100, but trying to like really get have a stable place in top 100. The difference in the mentality and the commitment level and just the value of being.
I think in a way, I feel like the sport, you kind of, I mean, I think a lot of people have the feeling that the sport hasn't kind of given back too much. Because once you're kind of top 100 and stuff, you're making a lot of money. You know, you're traveling to nicer places, the tournaments are nicer, they treat you better and all that. So in a way, because of all of your effort and everything you do, you're getting something back, you know, whatever it is, money or fame or whatever it is. I think one of the tougher things when you're out there is that, out of that area, is that you're not really getting too much back because you're not making a lot of money and whatever, you're grinding queues of slams and you're playing challengers and all that. And I feel like sometimes, I don't know, I think you kind of get, some people I think kind of get lost in that and kind of just, I don't know, maybe lose focus or they kind of just don't enjoy it the same anymore. And I think that one of the toughest things is to, you know, keep trying to rise and keep trying to get better instead of just kind of, you know, the motivation or the happiness kind of leaving you when you're there. Because it's tough. It is until you get, you know, to that point. So I think.
And you talked about like trying to get better and practice everything. So like, you know, I was here doing a clinic and I was just, so the biggest difference that I see between like a good junior player and a professional is them knowing how to practice.
Yeah.
Right, knowing how, you know, not to be on the court for 2.5, 3 hours because you can just injure yourself and you're not focused anyway that long. Or knowing how to sort of structure a practice. If you could talk to somebody who was, let's say 250 to 300, right, and actually had the potential to do it, what advice would you give them to sort of bridge themselves from 250 to 106?
I think finding the way that you have to work, like yourself. I think that everyone has a different way and everyone's a different, you know, player and personality and all that. But I feel like the top guys, I feel like they know themselves very well. And I think that the biggest thing is knowing what you need, the way you need to play, the way you need to train, the way you need to take things. And I feel like the more you know yourself, the better then you can, you know, do things for your tennis and all that. I think that, just learning about yourself is the best way.
So I got a phone call right now from a federation that's like sort of retooling, you know, their player development, sort of their structure on how they support players at different levels. What do you think, like, as a country? You know, because I'm, you know, from what I do, I always try to look at the next wave, especially minority players. How do we help them? They got the talent, got the skill set, honestly are poised well to compete with the quality of athletes that come from across the pond, mm-hmm. right? But we need to do more for them. What do you think, from a federation standpoint, we could do for the players that are 100 to 200? To try to stabilize their careers and sort of put some gas in their tank?
I think for one is opportunity. So number of tournaments you play, I feel like that's huge. The amount of tournaments that there are, I know there's been a pandemic and stuff, but if you compare the amount of tournaments that we kind of have here compared to Europe or specifically like Italy, even this year, South America and all that, I feel like opportunity is huge. Cause yeah, I mean, you have U.S. Open, you have, you know, Miami, Indian Wells and stuff, but not a lot of players get to play that. I feel like the opportunity from the bottom is extremely important in how many players filter through. I feel like that's huge. I mean, this year we've barely had any tournaments until later in the year, and we've only had, let's say, I don't know how many challengers we've had, but we've had maybe 8 challengers or 10 challengers, I'm not sure, something like that. And I mean, in Europe, they have 10 challengers in 3 weeks, you know what I mean, or in 2 weeks. And I don't know, it's just different. I mean, South America now has had 3 months in a row of tournaments, and I just feel like that's important because if you have the people in the same country playing the same tournaments in the same conditions and they have opportunities week in and week out, I think that changes everything.
Right, so like get points and travel affordably, and not always have to travel abroad.
And playing in kind of the conditions that you're used to, because you know, for us, we have to go to Europe and we have to fly a long way and all that, but then we have to play on clay against people who play on clay all year. And that's just an example, but like, I feel like opportunity here, yeah, is huge.
No, that's good. I mean, because one of my thoughts is some of the revenue from some of our slams or bigger events could be trickled down to fund hundreds, right, or 125, so that the next wave of players can sort of build the ranking up so we can just have more representation
I think
at
so.
The slams. You
I
know?
Think so. I think
so. But I think, man, that was a perfect suggestion. But I think, I think we're seeing they're more open to that. And, you know, hopefully they listen to this. And
hopefully.
That was a good idea.
Hopefully.
Well, man, I appreciate you coming. Always, you know, every time you play team tennis, I'm not watching the match. I hear that boom. I'm like, okay, that's Ulysses. he down there dropping bombs, right?
Appreciate it. Yeah, I mean, you do what you can do, you know. Yeah. I do my best.
Right now, you can serve, so.
That's all I do. That's all I can do.
I appreciate you, brother, coming on, and I root for you and wish you luck and always watching out for you, watching your stats and, you know, cheering you on. So, man, appreciate you coming.
Thank you. Thank you, brother.